Let's turn our Bibles, please, tonight to the book of 1 Timothy, in the third chapter, 1 Timothy chapter 3. Continue our walk through of this pastoral epistle. Paul is talking about the ministry of the local church and how a church ought to behave itself, how it ought to function and run, various descriptions and instructions given to the church, to Timothy particularly, and to the church in general. And Paul is going to continue this discussion now as we get into chapter 3, in the first seven verses, by talking about the role of the pastor, the qualifications of the pastor. There are two offices described in the New Testament. You have the office of pastor and you have the office of deacon. And so Paul is going to spend the first seven verses here talking about the pastor. And then in verses 8 through 13, he'll discuss the office of deacon. It was important for Timothy and the church at large to understand these two roles as the church was beginning to take shape early on in the first century. Again, this is written around the year 60 or so A.D. And so we're about 30 or so years removed from Christ's ascension. The church is just in its baby stages. And so instructions need to be given regarding the leadership of a local church. And who and what kind of man is going to be needed to lead these churches that were really sprouting up, beginning to sprout up all over the place. As Paul was traveling, people were being converted, churches were being established, and some kind of structure, some kind of authority structure needed to be put in place. And Paul, with his apostolic authority, thought it important, under the leadership of the Spirit of God, to describe these things for Timothy. And he's also going to do similarly for Titus, as he was on the island of Crete, and to give these qualifications for a pastor. So let's read verses 1 through 7 of chapter 3. This is a true saying: if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and to the snare of the devil. Really, two primary questions to ask tonight. This is your outline. Lots of blanks because we're going to walk through these qualifications of a pastor. But the first question to ask is, what is a pastor? That question may be puzzling to many people. What is a pastor anyway? I remember golfing at one point with a neighbor friend of mine, and he asked me on the golf course, so how did you become a priest anyway? And that was his mindset. He had that background, obviously Catholic background, and so that was what he was familiar with. And he didn't quite understand what a pastor was in the biblical sense. But what is a pastor? Verse 1 gives some descriptions of what a pastor is. First, the pastorate is an overseeing ministry. It's an overseeing ministry. When the New Testament speaks of the role, the office of pastor, there are three Greek words that are used to describe that role. And those three Greek words are translated in five different ways. And we have those five ways in our New Testament, and they're really grouped up in 1 Peter chapter 5. If you want to look at that later on, you can. But three Greek words and five English words used to communicate this office. We have here in this text, we have it in the English as the word bishop in verses 1 and 2. That is the Greek word episkopos. And that is a word that's either translated bishop or overseer. Could be translated either way. That communicates the function of the pastor, that he oversees the church ministry. Another Greek word that's used in the New Testament is the Greek word presbyteros. That word is translated as elder. That word communicates the dignity of the church office of pastor. There's this elder. It communicates even a sense of wisdom, perhaps, though not necessarily, age. Elder. And then the third Greek word is the word poimen. And that word is translated as pastor or shepherd and communicates the protection and the work of the pastor. So you have the words in English, bishop, overseer, elder, pastor, and shepherd. Those five English words, when you see that in the New Testament, they all refer to the same guy. Here we have again this word bishop. This is the word episkopos, and it emphasizes then the function of the pastor as overseer. Now, in this description, these qualifications, this passage here, there's very little to do with the description of what the pastor actually does. That in itself lends itself a question to many people. So what does a pastor do anyway? Don't you only work on Wednesdays and Sundays? Well, no. Wednesdays and Sundays happen because of what takes place the rest of the week. There's a lot that goes on. But this idea of bishop or overseer communicates that the pastor's function is one of oversight, or it could even mean management. It doesn't mean that the pastor's finger is in every part of the ministry, but it does mean that the pastor oversees it all. He has an interest in it all. He's responsible for it all. It's a ministry of oversight. It's not micromanaging the various church ministries, but it's being interested in what goes on. Secondly, the pastor is a noble ministry. Verse 1 says that if someone desires this office, that he desires a good work. I think the ESV says it as a noble task. There's an aspiration that takes place in the hearts of some men. Some men have a desire to be a pastor. And that desire is for a noble task, a noble work. It is intrinsically a good work to be interested in. It's also good outwardly. It really carries both of those nuances. To pastor is a noble calling. Now, that's not to say that other callings aren't noble. Every Christian is in full-time Christian ministry. No matter what vocation you have, every Christian is in full-time ministry. The difference between me as the pastor and lay people is that this is my vocation. This is what I do for a living. It's not a quote-unquote secular job. It is the pastorate, and it's a noble work. Thirdly, the pastorate is difficult ministry. It's a difficult ministry. It is a noble thing, but as the last word of verse 3 says, it is work. And that word implies energy and toil. It's hard work to be an overseer of a church ministry, no matter what the size of it is. Now, it's not perhaps the kind of manual labor that some others might be involved in their job. It is a lot of book labor. It is mental sweat, brain sweat, sometimes as I call it. And it can take its toll on a man, because it is a toilsome work. It can take its toll on a man physically if he does not take care of himself. It can take a toll on a man emotionally if he is not able to control his emotions. It can take its toll on a man spiritually because of the weight of the ministry. Paul mentioned that. He had the care of all the churches. The cares of the churches weigh a pastor down. It can take its toll on a man mentally through all the study and research that takes place. He has to keep up with reading things. It's not just reading commentaries or different theological books, though that is a large part of it. It's reading about what's going on in the whole landscape of Christianity, trying to keep his mental pulse on what's going on around him. The pastorate is work. So I challenge all the men, young and old, to consider whether vocational ministry might be something that you desire. Sometimes God calls an older man into the ministry out of the business world, and he calls him into vocational ministry. Perhaps that is something that's been on your mind. That's a noble desire. That's a desire for a noble task. But the desire to be a pastor is not the only necessary thing. Because as verse 2 through verse 7 go on, there are certain qualifications that must be met in order to be a pastor. Paul spends then the rest of this passage going through these several lists, 15 or so I think it is, different qualifications of a pastor. And that's what we'll spend the rest of our time considering tonight. So second question, what are the qualifications for the pastor? Desire is good, but a man must be qualified to pastor as well. Now, as Paul goes through this list, there's really no particular, it seems, and the commentators all agree, there's really no particular way it seems to strike or to group these in. It's not like he's going methodically through a particular grid that he's thinking of. So men have tried to group these in different ways, and I'll try to do the same tonight. But as we walk through these, I want us to understand that these qualities that it mentions here of a pastor are qualities that are not just for a pastor. In other words, these are qualities, character qualities, some of them, that every person should really strive for. There's really only two in the list that perhaps we could say are somewhat unique to the role, to the office of pastor. But the bulk of these are things that every one of us, particularly the men, as this is geared towards men more than ladies, that we should all be striving for. We don't have a pastor's Bible and a layperson Bible, where your Bible is different than mine. We all have this passage in our Bibles, and therefore it's profitable for all of us to learn. So let's walk through these then together. First, I'm going to call these general qualifications in verse 2. These first two seem to be somewhat umbrella qualities. The first one is that he must be blameless. Blamelessness does not mean sinless perfection. Everyone has struggles. Everyone sins. Okay? I'm a sinner. I know that. And you know that too. So I'm not hiding anything. I'm not fooling anybody. We're sinful people. Blamelessness has the idea that there is nothing in the life of the man, though, that can give an occasion for public reproach. There's nothing in the man's life that could put him in the hot seat, so to speak. He lives a consistent life with maturity and a measure of spirituality. Now, that's something that we should all be striving for, right? That is not unique to the pastorate. Every one of us should strive for blamelessness. Doesn't mean we're going to be sinlessly perfect. It means we're going to strive to be consistent, spiritual Christians. And if and when we do sin, we're going to repent and we're going to get it right. But blamelessness is the first one. Secondly, he must be faithful to his wife. Verse 2 says, after blameless, the husband of one wife. Of all of the qualifications in this list, this one has received the most attention. Because there is some, it seems, a bit of ambiguity as to the exact meaning of the phrase. It says he is to be the husband of one wife. The phrase in the Greek literally means a one-woman man. And as you read the various commentators, there are probably at least five different ways this has been interpreted by people. Let me give those to you. You don't have to write them down, but you can if you want. The first one is this: the pastor is married to the church. That he is the husband of one wife. So who is he married to? Who is the bride? It's the church. That mentality, that interpretation, is primarily espoused by who? The Roman Catholic Church. Okay, priests are forbidden to be married, because the theory is, the idea is, they are married to the church. The church is the bride of Christ, and they are married to the church. But there are some major concerns with this, one of which is that it's nowhere else warranted in the New Testament, including this one. So that view is not the biblical view. Another way this is interpreted is that this is a prohibition of polygamy. In other words, a man can only be married to one wife. He is the husband of one wife. Only one. He cannot be a polygamist, meaning more than one wife. So he can only be married to one woman at a time. Now, is that a true statement? Sure it is. The Bible everywhere prohibits polygamy. Old Testament people, yes, I know we're married to more than one woman at a time, but that was never condoned by God. So polygamy is obviously the case, but that's true all throughout the Scripture. This is not really the predominant emphasis of this verse, by the way. Interesting to note, though, that polygamy has been taught in the Mormon Church over the years, although that has seemed to wane somewhat over the time. But that second view is not really the biblical view either of this phrase. The third view is this, that this is a prohibition of remarried widowers. That those men whose wives died and who get remarried, that they are not allowed to be pastors because they're only supposed to be the husband of one wife. But that view doesn't seem to match with other scriptures, particularly Romans chapter 7, verses 1, 2, and 3, which seem to teach otherwise. The fourth view is this, that this excludes unmarried men. In other words, that in order for a man to be a pastor, he must be a husband of a wife. But that doesn't seem to be the issue either, because the author, humanly speaking, the human author of these verses was who? Paul. Was Paul married? No. So that doesn't seem to jive with scriptural truth generally either. The fifth view is this, that this is a prohibition of divorce. That a man who has been divorced cannot be a pastor. And that view of all the others seems to have the most warrant to it. Now, as I said, this particular qualification of all of them has received the most ink in books, has received the most attention in conversations and so forth regarding these qualifications. I've looked at a dozen commentaries ranging from the 1700s to modern day commentators, and there really is no consensus of meaning in those five that I gave you. Meaning there is some variation. They don't all agree on one. Virtually all of those 12 agree that an overseer should not be a polygamist. That one's pretty much a no-brainer. I think there was one who didn't mention it, but that doesn't mean he necessarily agreed with it. Six of those that I looked at say that this particularly means that it is a prohibition of divorce. One of them mentioned that it means only one wife for his life, meaning that he could not get remarried under any circumstances. And that really is the biggest question at hand with this. Is Paul prohibiting any man who has been divorced from being a pastor? Now, like I said, there really has been, over the course of time, no consistent consensus to the exact meaning. So I will say this before I tell you my view, that good men differ. Really good men differ. My view on this, my contention is really two things in this. First, at the very least, this means that a pastor cannot be divorced and remarried after conversion. But perhaps it even means that divorce under any circumstance prior to or since conversion disqualifies him from being a pastor. I think those two qualities, the bishop must be blameless and the husband of one wife, have a relationship to each other. Divorce virtually all the time is never a one-sided thing. In other words, it takes two to have the problems. So if the husband has been divorced, that doesn't really seem to jive with him being blameless. There does seem to be, at least in my mind, some connection between the two. My position is that a man who is divorced cannot be considered for the office of pastor or deacon, because it says there in verse 12, later on that we'll look at, let the deacons be the husbands of one wife. Okay, same idea. Because there is so much question here, I want to give God the benefit of the doubt. It doesn't mean that divorced people are kept from serving in many other capacities in the church, just not pastor or deacon. They're not second-class citizens. They're just not qualified for that, those two particular offices. The second thing that I want to contend is that there is an unquestionable emphasis on marital fidelity. There is no question, everyone agrees, that this qualification means a one-woman man. In other words, that his entire focus of his attention, of his affection, is on his wife. Marital faithfulness. Everyone agrees. No question about it. We can disagree perhaps on the more intricate nuances of who and under what circumstances, but everyone agrees faithfulness is necessary. A man's attention, his affection, his support emotionally, spiritually, physically is on one woman, his wife. Those are the first two general qualifications. We took more time on those two than we will the rest of them, so don't worry. Secondly, personal qualifications, also in verse 2. First one here is that he is clear-headed. This is the word vigilant in the King James. It means to be sober-minded in judgment. It indicates being clear-headed. The word itself, in its original language, means abstinent from wine or sobriety. Josephus, the great historian, used it in that way in his writings. It also means sober-minded or sober in judgment, that his thinking is not clouded or confused by outside influences other than God's word. That he is sober-minded, he's vigilant, as it says here, or that he is clear-headed. Another one, he is self-controlled. In the King James, this is the word sober. And that word means he has a properly regulated mind. He's sober in his thinking. Now, that doesn't mean he walks around being a grump all day, long-faced and scowling looked. Look, that's not what it's communicating. But it does mean that he can differentiate the time in joking around and the time for seriousness. The pulpit particularly is not the time to be a stand-up comedian. Why? Because he's self-controlled. He's sober-minded. Thirdly here, he is orderly. This is the phrase of good behavior in the King James. He's orderly. This is a respectable behavior, both inwardly and outwardly. He leads an orderly life rather than a chaotic life. Doesn't do things haphazardly. Not jumping around from one thing to another. but he's orderly and settled in his life and daily living. Fourth, he is hospitable. It's the phrase given to hospitality. And that word in the Greek literally means a lover of strangers. That he loves people. And that love of people is willing to show hospitality to them. Not just people that he knows, but even people that he may not know. Again, think of it in this context. First century Christianity, there were no Motel 6s. People stayed in people's homes when they came through. And Christians were expected to be hospitable. And the pastor, the qualification, is that he must be hospitable. Given to hospitality. Willing to share. Willing to host people. Even in his home. Next, he is able to teach. At the end of verse 2, this is apt to teach. Now, this is one quality that must be true of the pastor that does not necessarily have to be true of every other believer. But the pastor must be a man who is both willing and able to teach. And I think this does have implications with regards to both giftedness and training. It's one thing to like to speak or to teach. It's another thing to be trained how to do it. And admittedly, that's a lifelong pursuit. But there's a measure of giftedness in teaching. And there's also the training in that. Verse 3 then goes on and gives a series of negative descriptions. Not this or not that. And these all regard, it seems, at least I'm grouping it this way, his behavioral qualifications in verse 3. First, he is not a drinker. That is not given to wine. This doesn't just speak about being drunk, but even being given over to wine at all. Drunkenness is obviously condemned in the scriptures many times. But here the emphasis seems to be not a drinker. While much more really could be said about that subject, we're not going to dive into that tonight. We'll save that maybe for another discussion. But he is not a drinker. Secondly, he is not violent, but gentle. I'm grouping those two together because they seem to be paired. He is not violent, but gentle. In the King James, those are the words, no striker, but patient. Not violent, meaning he's not a quick-tempered man, nor is he given to physical violence. Rather, he's patient, or he's gentle in his demeanor. That doesn't mean he can't be firm at times. There is times for firmness. But the overall tenor of his life is one of gentleness. Thirdly, he is not money hungry. This is the greedy for filthy lucre. Money is not the driving force of his life. Earthly riches do not hold his heart. He cannot be a lover of money. Fourthly, he is not quarrelsome. This is the word in the King James here, a brawler. And that word means that he doesn't seek out contention either physically or verbally. Now, there are times that within Christianity, there are debates that are held, that men will debate, men will discuss different theological truths. But that debate can be helpful and appropriate, but contentiousness should never be in the case, in that situation. It's not we're debating to be contentious with one another. Contention is not a virtue. Even in those times, we are governed by truth, by patience, gentleness, and so forth. And then also, he is not covetous. This speaks of desiring what other people have. He is content with God's provision for him. Okay, so those are behavioral qualities here in verse 3. When we come into verse 4, it transitions in verse 4 into 5 and speaks of his family. And generally speaking, the qualification here is this: that he manages his own household well with dignity. He manages his own household well with dignity. His household involves wife, if he's married, children, if God is blessed with children. But it even can go beyond that. How he manages his home. There should be an observable sense of successful management of the home, including its care, even the financial management, and other areas. Most of the attention, though, with regards to this particular quality, gets placed on the pastor and his family, wife and children. Pastors, not their wives nor their children, are perfect. Okay, we're not perfect. Everyone knows that my family has imperfections. You know that as well as I know that. But one thing that should be true of all families is that those issues are dealt with in a biblical fashion. We all have issues. We all have warts. We all have sinful tendencies. That's not the secret. The issue is, will we deal with them biblically and properly? Will we manage that well, with dignity? Now, I take this particular quality seriously because I know that it's not only my testimony that's important, but the testimony even of my wife and of my children are important to my role, my qualification, even as a pastor. If my marriage is not honoring to God, my ministry is in trouble. If my children do not live in subjection to me and my wife, then my ministry is in trouble. If I do not manage with dignity, as it says here in the verse, in a dignified, God-honoring way, then my ministry is in trouble. And that is a serious thing. Therefore, the management of my family, of my home, is important. And verse 5 goes on to say why. Why is that so important? Well, because if a man knows not how to rule his own house, then how will he care for God's church? Paul is reasoning really from the lesser to the greater. If you can't manage the small, you can't manage the greater. That's the logic. That's true, right? He is faithful in little, can be faithful also in much. So again, this is important to me, and I pray about this often. God, help me to be the kind of leader that you want me to be, like we discussed this morning. And I pray for my family regularly, frequently, and that I could manage my household well with dignity and grace. Verse 6 goes on then and describes really the second thing in the list that is necessary to be a pastor, but not for everyone. And you'll see why in just a minute. Verse 6 describes a spiritual qualification that he must not be a recent convert. That's the word novice here in the King James. Not a novice. This speaks to the fact that a man, to be qualified for the pastorate, cannot be recently converted. Now, of course, there's going to be a time that every Christian is going to be a novice. But for the pastorate, he can't be, meaning he cannot be recently converted. That implies that he must have a level of spiritual maturity. There should be some amount of time between his conversion and his being an overseer, though no particular time is specified in really any text. But it's stated he cannot be a novice. He cannot be a recent convert. There must be teaching. There must be training. There must be maturity that is displayed there. Look at the Apostle Paul. You read about his personal life after his conversion. He spent years before really commencing the bulk of his public ministry. And the warning that follows here in verse 6 indicates that a novice who is put into this kind of position of authority, that he runs the risk of spiritual pride. And it says in verse 6 that lest he be lifted up with pride, that he fall into the condemnation of the devil. And that phrase, lest being lifted up with pride, speaks of like being enveloped in a cloud of smoke, that he's just filled with pride. And in that condition, he fall into the condemnation of the devil, meaning the same kind of condemnation that the devil has received. And remember, the devil was consumed with pride. So it's making that comparison there. Pride always brings opposition from God. And here's another description of that. And then in verse 7, we get into a testimony qualification. And perhaps some might even say that this last one somewhat brings us back around to even the first one of blamelessness, though from a different perspective. Maybe the first one, blamelessness, might have more to do with being blameless in the eyes of the church people, perhaps. This verse goes beyond that scope and talks about his testimony in the community to those outside, them that are without, as it says. These are unbelievers. This is the general populace. And this is the qualification that he must have a good reputation with outsiders. His general testimony in the community should be such that is good and without anything to condemn as well. He has a good report, good testimony, good reputation, even of those unsaved people that he knows. Now again, these qualifications, with the exception of maybe those two that I pointed out, those are things that everyone should strive for, particularly our men. We should all strive for greater heights of holiness and purity in our lives. But this passage is particularly addressed for the pastorate, the qualifications for a pastor. Any church, then, who is looking to fill this office of pastor must put that man through this kind of grid. When a man is ordained into the ministry, he's put before men, and yes, they grill him on his theology and some views of different things. But many of them also probe the family and probe other aspects of life. There's a general questioning to see, is this man qualified? And we view that as God's investigation, really, of the men who are put through that kind of scrutiny. And Paul mentions that later on. He'll get into that discussion over in chapter 4. As well, about the laying on the hands of the presbytery and so forth. We'll talk about that later. But these qualities ought to be looked for when a church is looking for a pastor. There are three churches which we have listed in our prayer sheets on Wednesday night that are currently looking for a pastorate. And three others that were, that now have a pastor. From what I've heard about all three of those, Scarborough, Plymouth, New Hampshire, and Williston, Vermont. All three of those, from what I know two of them personally, one better than the other. I don't know the one in Williston. But from what I've heard of those men, they are godly men, qualified biblically. But there are three other churches whom we're praying for, that God would bring in men like this. Qualified men, godly men, spiritual men, who could lead those pastorates. Heartland, Maine is one of them. Baker River Bible Church is another one. Farmington Avenue Baptist Church down in Connecticut, they're looking for a pastor too. We ought to pray for God to bring a man like this to their attention, that a qualified, God-honoring man would rise to the surface, would be called to their attention, and would be called even to their pulpits and serve in that office of pastorate. But we are also to pray for each man in our church, both young and old, that we would strive again for these kinds of things. You think about these. These are qualities that are in keeping with the character of Christ. And we are called to be conformed to his image. No, he wasn't married. I know that. But the character qualities of Christ is what we should be striving for as well. It'll take humility, takes God's grace, and we ought to pray for that. So may we commit ourselves to these kinds of qualities in our lives, striving by God's grace
to be the kind of members and leaders God wants us to be for His glory. Qualifications for a pastor. Next time, Lord willing, we'll jump into verse 8 through 13 and talk about the other office of a church, that of the deacon. Let's take our hymnal tonight and we'll turn together.